Ritter Jansen is perhaps best known for his work, My Life as a Dog. Described variously as tender and tragic and hilariously funny, My Life as a Dog came out to both critical and popular acclaim in 1983. In 1985, it went to screen, and Sweden that year awarded it its prize for the best film in Sweden. In 1987, in this country, the Academy awarded it an Oscar nomination as the best screenplay from another medium. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversation. Stay with me now while we talk with sailor, poet, novelist, autobiographer, playwright, and screenwriter, Ritter Jansen. You have described that you have said that you had all the prerequisites to become a writer. You described in another forum a lousy childhood, escaping from school at a tender age and running off to sea. This may seem like an obvious question, but I'm not seeking the obvious answer. What is it about these life experiences that made you the writer that you are?
Well, I don't think it's an obvious question. I think it's a very hard question to answer. if I knew that. I think that what it is easier to live in a melting pot and in an event of very, very, very many strange events in your life when you're younger, and then later on trying to put them together if you survive, then know the answers by an academic career, and you have a lot of philosophy, and you know how to put things together when you go out, and you don't see anything, but instead you want to put labels on things. Mm. So, for example, if you live on a ship with 30 men, and you can't get away from that ship, you learn a lot about Freud, but you have never heard of Freud, and you know a lot about group pressure, and you know a lot about you learn a lot about hierarchies and the captain and down to the mess boy, and also you learn about loneliness and inner lives of men who suddenly start to sort of throw out their whole lives to you as a young kid because they have no one to speak to. And then later on in your life, you come to a stage where you have to put these things together and organize them, and so you start to read maybe theory and other things, and I think that there are many answers why you want to write about your experience, but one answer is that I find writing a good way to learn about things. So I do it mostly for my own reasons, writing, and then if it comes out good, then I might publish it. So that's...
Do you think that there is any danger in learning to write by book, learning the forms and the methods in a classroom from a teacher?
I don't believe that you ever can learn to become a writer, because I do think that you have to have some kind of inner whatever, weirdness or whatever it is that puts this soul into the need of expressing itself in writing. But I do believe that if you can find that person, you can, who knows how to fly without even knowing about flying. If you find that person, you can learn that person more tricks, how to fly, so to speak, how to write. And I do think that learning about writing in the process of especially when you come to forms like playwriting and then screenwriting, it's a very, very hard task to learn that. And that's a special skill above the ability of expressing oneself as a novelist. Writing a novel is very easy. I mean, you can do anything in novel. I mean, you say that my mother died, and then I went to Las Palmas, and I was going around the bars, and then I got tired of it, and then I went home. I mean, that's easy to write. Everyone believe you, but make it as a movie. That takes 50 minutes to sort of build up that part, maybe even more. when you write novels, I read novels today that I'm supposed to make screenplays out of, and you can see enormously loopholes in prose because you can get away with almost everything, and that is because the reader is a much more active part, I think. You fill in.
The reader's imagination.
Exactly.
And on the screen, it's so visual.
Yeah. And you will fill in what's needed into a book. It's a dialogue, and not a much. It's a more democratic dialogue with a novel, I think.
When you're writing, do you find that you stand outside, watching in, to the scene that you're writing, or outside if you're writing about yourself in one of your in one of the volumes of your autobiography, that you're standing outside radar and looking in to how he feels, what he does, the impact of things around him?
Well, I hesitate to say that, that they really are my life, these two books I've written. Now, I've written many other books, but because that I look upon it as a kind of research as well. So I do a lot of fact research about, I mean, the period of time, the way of thinking when they were young in the 1950s in Sweden. You read magazines, girls' magazines, where they write to the doctor and ask questions about, I kissed the boy, am I pregnant now? Or things like that, you know. And things, you tend to forget those things when you're over 40. And then you sort of store up this magazine that is a memory of knowledge that you may store up for years before you even start to write. And some of the memories of your own start to come back because you have a new knowledge. And then you say, well, it's there are more truths to life than just my own little soul here. So you put together things that you sort of steal from whatever and materials. When you start to write, you have all this, hopefully, in your guts. And that's when you do not step outside of your writing, because if you do that, you are way off. I mean, you need to, it's like hoisting up water from a well. And you start in the morning, you hoist up that water from underneath your whatever dreams you have. And 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it's drying up there, and no more comes out. And then you don't think about what you have written. If you're not prepared, you just write, and then you start to maybe later shape it and see, well, it wasn't good enough, or you have to sort of rewrite parts. But I'm amazed. When I wrote My Life as a Dog, there is a sentence in the beginning of the first 2 pages that says, I do not know if I want to be old at once or if I should stay young, because if I get old at once, I might be able to take care of myself, or something like that. He says like that. I mean, he wants to be old so he feel more secure. And then I happened to meet my uncle and his wife a week after I started to write this book. And his wife said, do you remember that you never knew about if you wanted to be old or not? You wanted to be old very quickly, or you wanted to stay the same age as a baby? And she started to talk about this, and I didn't remember that, but it came up.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so memory is a very tricky thing, and I don't believe in writers who actually pretend to say that they remember everything about their childhood. I think that's very pretentious.
The blue chair, the dress grandma always wore.
And my grandma always had this, whatever. What you do is that, what I like to do is to be true to a little child's feeling. You felt lonely, you felt heartbroken, you were very happy. And then you remember that, and the shadows around, they start to sort of come up. But as a writer, you can always paint those shadows and make them believable and form the feeling within the story.
And to paint it, to continue what you said, on a broader canvas than just this boy who once was.
Yeah, there are many examples in this book that is a broader canvas. For example, in the story in the book, but not in the movie, there, I happen to write about a man who has lost his eyesight, and he's very old, and I have to read for him magazine about women's underwear. It's a catalogue for Sears catalog or something. I don't know. What's the big store? The reason the boy reads and it gets through, comes through in the book, is that he has lost his eyesight as a glass worker, because you got this gray, what is it? It's like a horn. What's the name? You have to operate it in order to get better. And I didn't know that. But
like cataracts or glaucoma.
And but then I read a research report on that, and it just dawned on me that, well, that's the reason why he couldn't see. And I was a kid. As a kid, I had this to read for him, and so many things like that. You can sort of put in without pointing with a big finger, index finger, saying that this is a fact about glass workers or something.
Do you find it hard or easy to write? Do you bleed onto the page, or does it just come for you?
Well, that's I don't know. I try to do anything in order to not write. I build bookcases, or I move to build a house or something, or I invent a lot of things in order not to write, but I think that's okay. What is hard is to decide actually to start to write. When I really start to write, it's just a matter of a technical thing and the feelings. But I write my five pages a day or something like that, and it just goes on until it's finished. And I never have any anxiety about it, but of course you have to close yourself in a little bit to your family and other people. So it's a lonely business in that sense, but the problem is to start. And I have a trick to do that. I used to tell people that I'm going to write a novel, and then I start to tell the story, and then I get so ashamed that I haven't written the book yet, so finally, I have to go home and write that novel.
Trapped, because they're asking you, how's the third chapter?
Exactly.
Right?
I'm talking about this third installment, you know, because I want to write three novels about this boy and the character. And the main goal for writing this novels is really about, I want to find out what is a man, really. So I started with this relation, mother-son, and the second book, my father, his son, has a sort of broader scope, because my father, his son, that's the whole society, and there is someone up there too who is a father, and he's presented his son, and so that's the second book. And then actually that book is called The Burial of a Dog in Swedish, in Swedish, a burial of a dog means that there is something rotten in the state of Denmark, or there is something fishy. And in that book, he has become a man as well, and he is a little tricky. In the third book, I'm going to call that Dog's Paradise. So I'm waiting, and I'm talking about that book now because I'm waiting to get that shame that says that now, Raider, you have to write that book.
Dog's Paradise, is this indicating you plan a happy life in future for?
I think that the happiness that one can get in life is a very simple acceptance of chaos. I think that's the only happiness you would get. Yes. And that's the last story is about this man who tries to put all his children and family together and try to sort it out and give them what he can give, but they don't seem to be very interested in it, as often happens when you get older. He's very afraid of chaos, because he wants to organize this dog's paradise, and sort of he's afraid of that it falls apart, but then he actually sort of accept that chaos is a normal state of life, and you have to accept that. And I'm about on the brink of that acceptance, and but I'm not really there yet, so I want to wait a little. I think that when you're about to become 50, you sort of accept that this is it. It's not going to be better.
This would be a good time to reintroduce you. Radar Jansen was born in 1944, so he's merging on his 50th year, more or less. He has written 8 novels, including My Life as a Dog, the one we have been discussing, and in the American version, My Father, His Son, has come out this year. The Burial of a Dog is the Swedish title. There is one more promised. He has also, as I've indicated earlier in the program, been responsible for several plays and TV productions, and is working now as a screenwriter, as well as on thoughts for coming novels. I want to take you back for a minute. It intrigued me in reading about you that your early novels were quite different than My Life as a Dog or My Father, His Son. A Mighty Fortress, which came out in 1970 and for whites only in 1969, seemed very angry books. They called up the racism of South Africa, other countries in Africa, in the United States, and also challenged some values that are very close to the Swedish heart. Was this Radar Jansen, the angry young man at that point? Were you taking on the demons in your life?
I don't know. As a sailor, I saw the dark side of America, and incidentally, I'm still banned in South Africa as a writer. So,
because of what you've written?
Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't that easy to see, as a young boy coming to from this paradise, Sweden, where everybody is sort of not middle class, but it's. I didn't realize that the world was that in that bad shape, in a sense that, and especially when you're a sailor and you work in Africa, South Africa, you come to ports in America and you see. You sort of, it is not like you're landing at an airport and then a limo is picking you up and then you're visiting Rockefeller or somebody. This is quite different, even though I actually visited one of the sons of Rockefeller. He doesn't know it, but he had an au pair there that I visited in the 60s. That's a long story. I think it has to do with the history in our recent years. I mean, I'm 44, and when I came to Sweden, as I say, came to Sweden because I only visited Sweden when I was a sailor. I was about to be 23, and there were a lot of students on the port side quay and with. Saying banned as South African oranges or something, and I wasn't thinking of politics in that terms. I were more humanly, as a human, concerned about what I saw about the poverty, and I couldn't put it together. I mean, I was only 16 years old when I saw the last part of the Battle of Algeria, and I was very confused about what's going on there. So I think the books were attempts to put those pictures together in my mind, and also the I was very intrigued by the whole movement in the world at that time. The Students' Revolution was an invention here in America. It came over to us, and we started to think about the war in Vietnam, and we started to think about the Third World and the poverty. And I was involved in that wave of events. I was a young, angry young man, you could say, but I was never that angry because I was a very practical person. I knew how to load a ship. So I asked the students, well, why are we reading Mao Zedong here, and why are we discussing all this Marxism? Why don't we sort of just write an article and do something very practical about this? Now, you couldn't stop a building of a parking lot and have that as a park, that was not the goal. The goal was the final revolution. So I found that rather silly, and I thought it was another, it was the same oppression in those smaller groups of people that were in the bigger groups. It was, you needed a father, you needed a leader. So I was never that much intrigued by that part of it, but I was intrigued by learning. So that's why I wrote those books. And I was much more serious, as you are when you're young, because you, mm-hmm. you, I don't know, you think you're somebody. I don't know, it's, you think you can change things. And I think I actually have changed a couple of things. I wrote, when I found out that, well, this is too much politics now, I wrote a little novel about my grandmother. And it's only 104 pages. And I thought, nobody wants to publish a book about my grandmother because she hasn't done anything in her life. I mean, she was a working class woman who took care of the children and planted the garden and had all those jars in the basement. And I mean, wonderful person. And she is the one, also the one who sort of actually inspired me to become a writer, because she was a storyteller. So I decided that I wanted to write a book about her. And how do you write a book about an old woman? So I started to polish her own language into sort of a poetry, very short bits and pieces of her lives. And when that book came out, it was like, oh yeah, we have a memory, we have a grandmother, and everybody spoke about the book the same way as with My Life as a Dog, in a sense that they related very much, and it was
touched
a big
the chord.
Yeah, I think I changed people's view, even though at that part in Sweden the women liberation was a very strong movement, so they hated me because I was the first who wrote about that did that kind of a portrait, but that's I can take that.
You said in this same forum I referred to earlier that a person should never try to write an autobiography until they're at least 40. And it is at least in part because you take yourself too seriously before the age of 40. What are you learning in your fourth decade about yourself or about life that has changed the way you write? Clearly it's added humor to it.
Well, I think it's what you learn is that you have to go back to basic, and you go back to what you really enjoyed when you started to be a little bit older than just a kid. I mean, what intrigued you? And so then you have to say, this is me. This is how I write. This is like the way I want to tell stories. And before, you want to please critics, you want to please somebody. Be somebody, yeah. And then suddenly you say, well, this is enough. I've come to a point where I can see that if the writing is not giving me any more than recognition, there is a turning point where you could say that you're not going to be true to yourself. Because there are a lot of materials, a lot of things you want to tell, and then you start to go back to that. And you say, well, my grandmother was right, or my father was right. You can start to accept things like that.
And you get to the point where you can tell the small story, your grandmother's story.
Yeah.
And have it mean something.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't need to be the person who knows the most about Beethoven's life or something like that. There are other people who are better, and I don't need to be somebody that I not can be, but I can certainly be the one I am, and I can do it very well, maybe. That's my goal for the rest of my life, to change the ever-turning shades around the person. Everybody has put shades on a stage from their past, and when you realize that you do the same thing over and over again, you decide that there are a couple of shades you want to take away, and there are another you want to invite into your body and say that this is a part of me, and they're going to be friends. And that has to do with relations between people as well. And relations between a man and a woman as well, I think. Love and compassion.
Do you, I have no idea whether this is true, do you find as you write, because writing for you is a learning experience, that your life changes incrementally, you learn more?
There certainly was a period in my life when my life changed rapidly, because I put up certain goals. I said, I want to know about Sweden. So I wrote a novel about Sweden's unemployment and the economy of the sort of inner core of how we put Sweden together, the Swedish welfare program and things like that. And I studied that for over a year before I started. So it changed me, because then I felt that I knew where I came from, and the book about my grandmother was another phase in that. And then I set up this goal about writing about men. I wrote a book called Living Life that was a little bit of a failure, because I couldn't really get to the core of what I aimed at. So I do hope that I still have that kind of goals that I sort of see far away, that I want to do this because in my writing it's gonna at the same time change me as a person. I don't know if I succeed, but I like the feeling of trying. So it's very hard to answer. There are certain patterns that are very hard to change in a person, I think. And one big change, I think, I have managed was that when I felt that now I know Sweden and now I want to go back to become this international wanderer. I didn't know where and how, but just feeling of I've gained a home in Sweden, and now I don't know, I can live anywhere. There is no place that is sort of scary, or I don't have a home. My home is where I write.
This is Conversations. We're talking with Radar Jansson. I'm Susan McInnes. Don't you think in some ways that's a product of the 40s, being in the fourth decade as well? You know yourself better, know where your feet belong on the earth, and you can be comfortable here, so you can sort of belong anywhere, write anywhere, be who you are anywhere?
Well, I don't know something that turns on automatically.
I
don't know that. I have had hard struggles with myself and my own life and my behaviors, and I think I have seen people and friends who are in their 70s and 60s, and they, when they, for example, start to talk about their parents, you can see and you can hear in their voice that they become little children. I have seen writers who has written about their childhood, but they've never understood their childhood. I read the books, and I think, and met the persons, and I can see that this is clearly another force of hatred or force of no, strange shadows that sort of moves that writer. You can take a writer like Hesse, for example, in Germany. He could never get rid of his childhood, I mean, that's for sure. He never learned to understand the evil and dark sides that drove him all his life.
So the angst came out in his writing?
Well, they certainly did, yeah. I mean, that's for sure. Yeah. And. There are also writers who are very afraid of touching things deep inside them, because they want to have their angst. They want to have this as a motor. And they say, don't touch that part of me, because that is that is the mode of my whole writing. This is the engine that sort of forces me to get this drive.
So therapy or personal evolution would be disastrous for the writer's craft to that person?
To that person who believes that, maybe, I don't know. I myself has gone far behind that, and I think that it is sheer nonsense. I think that if you have a piece of frozen meat and if blood that melts down a little by the microwave of psychoanalysis, and then you start to get feelings and things again, and because there are parts of human bodies that are rather frozen inside people, and if you can get a little trickling here and there, and doesn't change you as a writer, it's just a strange concept that is very popular. I think the opposite. And learning to understand oneself I think everybody has to do that. Here we are in America, where you have a total opposite culture, where you say, "I can do everything." In Sweden, we learn as kids to say, "I am not supposed to do anything." We have the opposite culture.
What does that mean? I'm not supposed to do anything.
Well, we call it the Jantelagen, and the whole society is built upon that everybody should think that nobody is anything. We are all equal, and if you try to say that, "Oh, I can write," you become a very strange and odd person in that society. And this has nothing to do with politics. This has to do with our culture far way back in our history. And even today, I think that we are driven by that law that was formed. It was written about by a Danish Norwegian writer who called it the Jantelag, and then that we all know about this law, who says that you are nobody, you should never think that you are anyone, you should never think that you can do anything, and so on and so on. It's the commandments of the Scandinavian culture. Whereas here in America, you learn to say that I can be the president, or right, I can be anybody, and I can change myself. Recovering is just around the corner. For anything in this country, and everything is possible here.
Let's turn to something else. There are a couple things I want to ask you about that are driven by culture. One is that. The second one is sexuality. In America, we deal with sexuality mostly with Snickers and giggles, it seems, and some repression. My Life as a Dog, both in film and in the novel, deals with sexuality quite openly, it seems. Do you feel that's true for your country, for Sweden? And what have you noticed in your cross-cultural experience that are the differences between the two of us?
I think that it's a little bit of a myth that Sweden and Scandinavia has been that country where that sexuality was like an open textbook for everyone, and we sort of raise everything up, and we have the searchlights, so that everything is like open in the daylight. I think that's a little bit of a myth. I think that we do have not that much openness as is believed, but we are certainly rather at ease at problems that, for example, here in America seems to be a huge, huge problem in the culture. There are many reasons why we are at ease in Sweden, in a sense. It has to do with the church. We are Lutherans, we forgot that we were Lutherans. We are sort of a very secularized country in that sense. Now there is a quest somewhere for people to belong to church again, maybe. But we have had a long period of nothingness, and But I think that sexuality and the question, I've lived in the Mediterranean for quite a while. I've lived in Africa. I've stayed here in America for some 3 years now. I think that we tend to have, I think that our pockets of people and communities that are very, very high, tense and strong about sexualities, but the mainstream everywhere is that it is a rather easy subject to deal with. But the pockets that sort of are making a pact together with religion I wouldn't say stupidity, because there are religious persons that are brilliantly intelligent, but it's some kind of fear for knowledge and a pact with that we don't want to have any changes. It's the same fear for chaos. Mm-hmm. Those pockets, they make rather big noises in the world, as here in America as well. But the people I meet in America, they are not like that. They deal with these things very the same way as we do in Sweden, I think.
So in some ways, we may be dealing with myths and loud noises when we think of it.
I think that is a little bit so, yes. And I think that we in the world should just go on with trying to be more and more open and let those pockets get as little air as possible for the burning part of it. So, because the more you start to discuss with this thing, the more you take it seriously. Form your own life, your own opinions on this, and raise your children in as much openness as you want. I myself is married to a woman now who has been grown up in a Catholic church and a school. I can't see any difference from a Swedish upbringing very much, actually.
I want to take a left-hand turn, if we can, and take a look at a couple of technical things with a lot of spirit behind them. When you take My Life as a Dog, a book in Swedish, and entrust it to a translator, or The Burial of a Dog in Swedish, and trust it to a translator to be transformed into My Father, His Son, what kind of courage do you take in hand, and what references do you check to make sure this person will create as lovely a book in another language as you've created in yours?
Well, it's a good question. I wish I could talk about it, because it's a question that has nothing to do with me, actually, in a sense, because the writer himself is never asked such questions from his publishers. The book goes away somewhere in the world, and I'm never asked if I want to have that translator. I've never given any letter saying that we have this wonderful translator, do you want to meet him or her? That doesn't happen.
Is that frightening, or do you just give it up and cross your fingers?
One of the sort of busy thing I've been doing is to both trying to get other writers to take their life in their own hands and also try to get more power over your own writing. And so when I experienced the first book here, My Life as a Dog, when that went venture into the world here, I said this is never going to happen again. Yeah. There were a few very, very good translators that sort of contacted me directly. They had questions about certain things in the book, and I was asked to come down to Germany to meet the translator for several days, and I was so tired, because he was really pinning down every word and asking about the language, which was fantastic. The English translator, she refused to speak to me. When I read yesterday here at the university, I suddenly changed a world because it was wrongly translated, and it would have been a total different meaning of that sentence. And I feel I wrote together with my American wife. We sent the first draft of the translation to the publisher and said that, well, we will have a problem here because Americans do not know what a tip is, for example. A tip is a dump, a waste dump or something. And there were other more longer conversations about the translation, but they refused to even answer my letter. They said, this is Britain and we know how to translate books.
So what's the future of the writer's revolution?
Well, the second book I took in my own hand. I cut off the publisher in Sweden, and I decided to find my own translator. And I paid the translator when I found the person that wanted to work together with me. I paid her out of my own pocket, and we worked together. And she's a wonderful translator. She's been living here in America for some 30 years, and she's a good writer as well, and a wonderful person that can be discussed with, because there are people you can't discuss matters with because they get afraid and sort of say, don't criticize me. So we collaborate and work now. I think she has done a wonderful job on My Father's Son, and that is what I hope writers are going to do. I mean, just go out on their own, find the right people, and see to that the translations are as good as possible. I know that for poets this is very, in a way, better, because poets tend to translate other poets, and it's like a world international community of poets who sort of find the Swedish poet, and then they become friends, and they sort of write letters and discuss the problem of this particular sentence of a poet, but poetry. But that has never happened to me as a novelist.
Where do you place the position of the writer generally
in the society? Or?
No, in relation to the people who are going to take you on, the publishers or for film, directors and producers. Is the writer in a pretty good position, or is the writer apt to get pulled around by the nose or ignored?
First of all, there can never be any movie, there can never be any prints of novels if nobody writes the story.
So crucial is the first answer.
It's very crucial. I mean, it's when I take the train to Stockholm, I tend to see this huge building where all the people who can spell lives, and that's where my publishers are. And I used to say, oh, they can spell, but I can write. But I guess that the salaries of their work is better than mine. I don't know. But and that is the second answer. I think that this very simple fact that it's so crucial that it has to be written, everybody in the business wants to hide. So they tend to say that the critiques is much more important, the publisher is doing the wonderful job, the agencies, the real packaging of the whole thing, and so on and so on. The actors are the persons who really hit the screen, and the directors. When it comes to novel, it's very simple. I mean, because that is the writer who gets the blame and the fame. And rightfully so. When it comes to filmmaking, I recently read a little research, just sort of by a film writer in Hollywood. And I read it in LA Times, and he has gone through 1 year of the newspaper, and he found out that when there was a film that was blamed and flopped, there was like 75% of the critics always blamed the writer. Mm. But if the film was a success and a good box office, there was exactly the opposite. It was 75% because of the director. So I mean, I think that And now if we talk about the differences between America and, for example, Sweden, in Sweden we have had a very long history of the so-called auteur theory in filmmaking, which means that the director goes out with a camera and the camera is the typewriter and he just sort of creates while he's there. And that was French theory that sort of damaged the whole European film industry in a way. The French, they like to make terrorists like that. It came to Sweden, it certainly helped Ingmar Bergman. But we don't have that many geniuses in Sweden. I mean, we are only a population of 8.5 million people, and we don't produce like 50 Bergmans every year there. But everybody likes to think that they can write and direct and do everything themselves, which means that the writing part has been like a left-hand job or something, which is bad. Has been very bad for our film industry. I think that in America it has been the opposite, because here it has been a very huge industry, and the industry needs to have its timber or lumber. There has to come the raw material has to enter, so they must have this big huge staff of writers out there writing and dreaming about getting the film, the script into a movie. So here you have a total different approach to filmmaking, where a writer is a very important person. And I used to feel that this is the first time I really feel like I'm alive, because in Sweden nobody wanted to speak to you. but here it's like the producers, they want you, they need you, and they know it. Often they spend time that I've never experienced in my life with the writer on the matters of the scripts and the story.
Gives you greater confidence in the film that may come out of your book.
Well, it might be, yeah, exactly, and yeah. In Sweden, what you try to do is to do it in a little bit more like you are trying to put together a family. I mean, you find a director or somebody like you almost marry, and you sort of you find a cameraman that you like, and then you put this family together, and then you have this feeling that you're in good hands. The family idea is, however, not always a good idea for art making, because then you try to be too nice, you know. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to have any struggle in your family. So you don't come up with, there are two little sparks in a way, in the process. So it's a very delicate situation where you try to find the person who loves you the most, and then you have to have all those sparks.
That's a fight.
Yeah, so I live together with a writer now, and I work together with a writer, and that's a very interesting thing to do, actually, because you need all this criticism and the sparks, and at the same time you have to make food together and have dinner together and see each other in the next morning. So it's very interesting. I like it. I better say that.
Good. This is Radar Janssen. I'm Susan McGinnis, and you're listening to Conversations. You described writing a novel as being like driving in a car. If you got lost, you could stop and look at the map. If you decided you liked the vista, you could drive off on the viewpoint and look at the hills beyond. But that writing a screenplay, something for the movies, was like riding on a train or a roller coaster. You don't have the time, the luxury to relax. How do you write differently when you write for a movie? What's it like being on the roller coaster?
It's fun, but it's not as fun as writing a novel. I have a very good expression for this, but I can't use it because I'm in America and we have discussed this. So I can't use it. I have to find another symbol. No, I won't say it. No. writing a novel it's more freedom. It's just, let's say it that way. And writing a screenplay, you're putting a corset on you, and you have to squeeze the story through this form. But there could be wonderful moments where you actually find, you hit the notes, so to speak, and you find that, oh, this is absolutely perfect. And usually I have those wonderful moments every day, and then my wife comes in and read what I've done, and then she says, what is this? This is totally wrong. And then she writes it, and then I come in next day and say, what is this? This is, I can't understand it. And then we go on like that. So the wonderful moments, they are sort of crushed at once, which is good. See, the clarity and the building of a screenplay is the hardest art of all. It's like trying to build a tower from very weak material. When you were a kid, you tried to build towers with cards, right? And then you were on the top here, and then suddenly, boom, it's just falling. And that's the same feeling you have when you see a movie that doesn't work. But when it works beautifully, and it's just, you don't bother. You're just on that roller coaster. But put those cards together and have them staying there and being in different colors and have all those wonderful ideas on them there. That's hard.
Do you diagram?
Yeah, we. The good thing with two people is that at least up to nowadays, you can't read your mind and a lot of people. You can't read the mind of somebody. So we have to speak a lot, right? We have to discuss a lot. And in order to remember that, we take those little scotch things and the yellow stickers, and we put them on a wall, and so we just write very, very brief notes on scenes like that, and then we have this whole movie on those stickers and on the wall. Some days the wind takes them away, but that's a
desperate moment.
Desperate moment, but usually you remember, and then what happens is that we are sitting there and looking at those yellow stickers and said, well, what if Jack here in the end actually, instead of hunting this walrus here or whatever, we start with that part. Mm. So we take that sticker and move it up to the beginning and say, this is the best images we can find of the whole story in a way. And so on and so on. And then when we have like 100 and something stickers, then we put it into the computer. And then I usually start to write a prose version of the movie, because I like to write the prose. And then my wife's, because she's more clever than I am when it comes to computers, she sort of put something into the computer that makes it a script.
Put something in.
I don't know, she presses some buttons and then there's a new program suddenly, and so they speak like with dialogue. No, but I can do that as well, I'm just joking, but right. She is the best one on it. So it's a process of, and the strange thing though, when you're under contract, as I am, incidentally, I write in English, so which is also has been now for 3 years a very hard task for me, because you can speak a language, but then start to write, and you should be on the top of the best in another language. That suddenly, when you're 47 years old, that was very hard in the beginning. I was so tired, I was just finished. But now I start to feel that at least I can maneuver within the screenplay. But I wouldn't try to write a novel in English.
I have a very big question to ask you, and we've only got about 3 minutes left. I'm going to ask it anyway. You said that Joseph Campbell on myth is one of the best sources for screenplays. Why? What does Joseph Campbell have to offer us for the movies?
Well, to put it very simple, there is a quest in the world that is a very confused world to look at people who solve problems instead of going to commit suicides in the end when they can't solve the problems. And if we go back to the storytelling, the old shaman in the little village, in an Eskimo village or an Indian village or an African village or maybe a Swedish in the old times, the stories that were told were supposed to teach the people how to survive. And how to survive was to remember facts about the society, but also the dreams of the society. Mm-hmm. It was a healing process. So Campbell tries to put together and analyzes the old sagas, the old Greek myths, the hero. What is a hero? Why is it that we need a hero? And what should a hero be for us? A good example. I think that we need a lot of heroes when you grow up. People who can tell you that this is good, this is bad, good and right. You shouldn't use drugs. If you use drugs, you die. If you stop using drugs and fight against it, you are a hero. I mean, it's very clear. And we under a pressure of very democratic, we have moved politics into families in a way. Mm. So we want to be very democratic. So we have raised children for a decade or two in a too democratic way because we don't tell them what is right and what is wrong. And I think that when we go back to those myths and sagas and storytellings, they always tell you what's wrong, what's right. And that is what we have to do mm-hmm. in storytelling. You have to complicate it. You have to tell the people, we are not going to tell you that this is easy. It's a fight to survive, to be a good person in life. And you are responsible for that. So everybody needs to have those heroes up there on the screen. And I'd rather write about those heroes than about something that sort of tells the audience that you can't do it.
Yeah.
You better go down the drain. So it's Campbell is telling about how this was done many, many years ago. And he evokes the whole question of putting those heroes and their quests for a better life or to win the princess or to the whole society, I mean the kingdom or whatever, back to today, because we need to win the princess. We need to become the white knight mm-hmm. instead of the dark knight. We need to feel that we are doing good in life.
Peter Jansson, I want to thank you very much for a most interesting hour. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Thanks for listening and join me again next week.
Thank you.